This is the Sam Romano interview for August 22nd, 2005.
Hello.
Hello, this is Anthony Young trying to reach Sam Romano.
Who am I speaking to?
Okay, this is Anthony Young. I'm writing a book on the history of the lunar rover.
Yes.
And I have spoken with everybody from Sunny Maria to many of the Apollo astronauts.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, I've seen your name mentioned many times in the information literature that I've gone through, and I was hoping I could spend a few minutes with you, talking with you, and get your side of the LRV story.
Okay, what are you doing it for?
Okay, the publisher is Springer Praxis. They're in England, and they have specialized in special space-related book titles for many years.
Sure, give me your name again. I want to write it down.
Okay, it's Anthony Young, and I'm calling from Miami, Florida. This is going to be my 10th book. It's my first space-related topic, but I've written on transportation subjects and had them published since 1982.
Yeah, what can you name a couple?
Okay, well, if you can go on Amazon.com, you'll find my books under Camaro. I wrote a history also on the Chrysler, Dodge, and Plymouth
of
performance cars. Most of these are of my what I call my automotive phase.
Sure.
But I'm currently a regular contributor to Space Times magazine.
Uh-huh.
And also the online weekly, The Space Review.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, my most recent one for them was an article I wrote called The First Woman on the Moon.
Oh, yes.
And I discussed the Eileen Collins, who was commander of Space Shuttle ST-114.
Yes.
And I am, actually this book is an outgrowth of an article I wrote for Automobile Quarterly about a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was just an article on the LRV, but I came across so much information. I was wondering, I looked and found that no one had ever written a book on the history of the LRV.
Really?
And I said, you know, this is a subject I really could get my teeth into.
Yeah. So, I just finished doing?
What's that?
I just finished ordering the Smithsonian model on the LRV.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, Code 3 has them, and I just bought four of them for my kids.
Oh, really? Because are they very detailed?
Oh, the best thing I've ever seen, really.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, beautiful. You can get them pretty inexpensive. I think she sold them for $72 each. And
oh, that's
great. I bought them about 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And $150 each for them.
My goodness.
Anyway, Anthony, give me your phone number.
Yes, my home phone is 305-255-2349.
You have an email?
Yes. A-H-Y-O-U-N-G.
H?
A as in Albert.
A.
Yeah, A, then H-Y-O-U-N-G. Those are my initials. A-H Young.
Okay.
At mail.com. And I'm in Miami, Florida.
Yes, I got that.
And I've also been going through, of course, but I've been up to Huntsville, the University of Huntsville. They have a terrific collection of literature that Sunny Maria had put together.
Really?
And then donated to the university. And then I also went out to the history office, of course.
Yes.
And, but I guess the biggest thing is my opportunity to interview John Young, Charlie Duke, Gene Cernan.
Wow.
And Dave Scott. I just finished an interview with Dave. Yes, he is. He's very hard to get hold of.
Hard to get hold of, but he doesn't like to talk too much.
That's what I understand, but I was able to be on the phone with him for about half
a... Did you see his new book?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
right.
And it was last April, I think, I had an opportunity to go to a breakfast with the astronauts up at the Cape.
Yeah.
Charlie Duke and John Young were there, Edgar Mitchell, and Gene Cernan. So we had three of the six lunar rover drivers there.
Hi.
And it was a real thrill to get to see him. And I had spoken with him on the phone, but I didn't get an opportunity to actually go up there.
All those things.
It's pretty hard to get close to those guys, you know. But
Jack Schmidt is another good guy.
Yes, he is. Harrison
Schmidt, he's hard to find, too. He's an Albuquerque, I think.
Yes, he's the last one I need to interview because, of course, I can't interview Jim Irwin.
Yes.
But he does have a book that he published, and I'm using that for some background information.
Well, I'd like to help as much as I can, Tony.
I would appreciate it. Let me say this, Sam. I have been writing for 25 years and publishing books for almost as long, and I have always submitted rough drafts of my articles or chapter rough drafts to those I've interviewed so they can review everything I've written, see it in context, say, you know, to make
it. Don't do that. They get it all screwed up. You get very angry.
I hear these stories all the time, and it infuriates me because I have a little thing. Once it's in print, it's forever.
Yes.
Especially with a book. You can do some changes online, but with a published book, you've got to get your facts right out of the chute. So
yeah.
If you've got about 20, 30 minutes, I have some questions for you, and I hope you can...
Sure. I'll be glad to send you some stuff, too, Tony.
Oh, that'd be great. I'll give you my address in a little bit.
Okay.
Of course, I've got a wealth of printed stuff on how the LRV program got started, but I think what I'd like to do first is find out...
I wonder if you really have the right story on that.
Okay.
What do you find out?
Well, much of it is the day-to-day memos and documents and that sort of thing about how the various companies were being considered and evaluated during the request for proposals.
Let me just give you a 5-second or 5-minute discussion what happened before that request for proposal came out.
Okay, great.
We've been working on that project you haven't asked me any questions. Let me start from the beginning how I got involved in this darn thing.
Okay, that'd be great.
I joined General Motors in 1960 in Detroit, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was head of special vehicle development. I talk pretty fast, so slow me down if you want.
Okay, go ahead.
Are you recording this?
If I may, yes, I'd like
you
to do
may.
That. And then
you
the, then I transcribe the tape.
I want to get it right.
Okay.
So I joined GM in 1960. I was working, it was an electronics company back east.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to Michigan, this was a division that was called GM Defense Systems Division.
Mm-hmm.
I joined them in 1960. At that time, the Air Force put out a requirement for a lunar base rover.
Okay.
And it was a big rover. It was something like 8,000 pounds.
Oh, yes, yes, of course,
And we decided to bid on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, that's GM and Allison together.
Okay.
Well, that didn't go. That program didn't go because NASA took over the space, the moon project then.
Mm-hmm.
And they get started on a rover of about the same size of an 8,000-pound rover. It's called the MOLAB.
Yes, I've seen pictures of that and stories on it.
I was a program manager of MOLAB for General Motors.
Oh, okay.
Right about that time, General Motors decided to move our division to Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And that's how I got here.
Well, then you've been in Santa Barbara for literally decades, haven't you?
24 years.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Since 1961. That's 40 years, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so when I came here, then I started doing research work on how do you build a rover to work on the moon. I set up a space environments lab where we could evaluate the mechanisms for operation in a zero pressure.
A vacuum, yes.
Vacuum, yeah. And we worked on drive, gears, and wheels. We worked a long time on developing wheels. And then after about a few years, NASA decided they weren't gonna do a large vehicle. They were gonna do an LSSM. That's a lunar.
Yes.
Three, okay.
Yes,
that was
that's
about
correct.
1,000 pounds or so.
Mm-hmm.
And that was gonna be Saturn, but we had two Saturn launches, one for the logistics support, and one for the astronaut.
Yes, that's a. I think they call that like a dual mode or something. No, I
Not dual mode, no. But anyway, I can send you the books on that. But
okay.
Just giving you a synopsis here so you know.
Okay,
that.
Great.
Okay. All right, then after they said they were going to have the big MOLAB, that 8,000-pound MOLAB, they were going to have a small one. It was a Apollo Logistics Support System. APLSS, Apollo Logistics Support System, as it was.
Okay.
ALAS. Okay, so then we reconfigured our study. We did some studies on a 2,000-pound vehicle. And we were very interested in high mobility. And I had a couple of real mobility people on my staff. One was Dr. Gregory Becker.
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. He was a proponent of a multi-wheel vehicles. And he was on my staff, as was Ferenc Pavlik, another Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked in that until about 1968.
Okay.
And then, all of a sudden, they said, well, we're not going to have a two-launch Apollo for lunar exploration.
Mm-hmm.
We're only going to have a single Apollo, just like the Apollo 11. And therefore, we can't fit that your big vehicle, so we just can't do it, so we're not going to do any vehicle work. So I said, damn it, that's not right, I said. So what we did was, I went to Washington, and at that time, there was an Army colonel running the Apollo logistics support system in Washington. His name was Tom, I forget his last name. I went to Washington, this is about late 68. I don't remember the exact date. I can go through my file and do it, but I don't have that right now. And I went there and I said, Tom, what can you handle on that single Apollo launch? Well, he says, we have an instrument bay available. And I said, well, what's the configuration? So he showed me the triangular configuration, the big pie-shaped configuration.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we can stand about 500 pounds, all we can stand. That's all we have. But that was what was in that bay. I said, what? Wow, it's hard to fit a vehicle in a pie at only 500 pounds. Wow. So we went back to Santa Barbara, and in 4 months, we did some studies, and we came up with a configuration that would fit right in that box of weight less than 500 pounds. So what we did was we made a 1/6 scale model of the rover.
Mm-hmm.
And a 1/6 scale model of the LEM. And we made a movie showing the LEM folded up and into the compartment, the instrument compartment. And then we deployed it, and we made a movie of it.
I see.
We took it down to Huntsville, and we showed it to the guys in Huntsville. And I don't know if Sonny Marie wasn't on the program then, but Len Bradford was the head of the gang. And we showed it. We wrote it down in his lab. He said, "Scott, you got to show this to Dr. Von Braun." So we went up to the ninth floor of the Von Braun Hilton. You know that is in Huntsville.
Yes, that's right.
So we went up there, and I put the model down, and we rolled it. We ran it down the hall remotely, and one of the NASA guys knocked on Dr. Von Braun's door, opened it up, and we drove the vehicle in there.
I see.
He was on the phone. His head stood up on end. He slammed the phone down. He says, "What have we here?" Well, that gave us an opportunity to tell him what we could do.
Yes.
After about a half hour, an hour, we were discussing it, showing the movies, and tell him how we could do it. He slammed his hand on the table and said, "We must do this." And so he then he got funding to do the rover for the Apollo, the single launch Apollo, and we were then able to put a bid in for it. Now you have the story from there on. See?
Okay. Okay.
They could do it. Then they had a bid competitively for it, which is the way that the government works. We understood that. We were not naive. So while we were doing that, the General Motors in the headquarters in Milwaukee, Detroit, said, "Well, you know, you guys have never built a man-rated system. You better get a subcontract. You better get a partner on this." So we had worked with Boeing on the MOLAB program.
Mm-hmm.
I called the Boeing guys and said, "Hey, let's bid this together. We have a real winner." And we talked about it. We all agreed to team up. And then we put the proposal in when the RFP came out that you have the information on, and we submitted, of course, as you know, we won.
Yes, that's right.
That's the story in a nutshell.
Well, that's great because, you know, that's a sort of the story behind the story.
Right.
I've got the big picture, but the political machinations, if you will, the corporate machinations behind all that, it seemed like it was working in a vacuum. It's just like I saw the progression from MOLAB to the LRV and all these various other vehicles.
You know,
that.
Yes,
that's right. And you'll read about those. See, Chapter 1 is devoted, and I'm trying to fit 50 pounds in a 5-pound bag here, but Chapter 1 is going to be the largest chapter in the book because it deals with the engineering of the LRV.
Yes.
From the early proposals for the U.S. Army lunar base idea and concepts, And then the progression from there to into the Apollo program, and then how the various Rover Concepts, Molab, and so forth got started, and how they finally evolved into the LRV program.
Well, the Army was not involved with the lunar base, the Air Force was.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, okay.
The Army came in lately. Dr. Becker was pretty...
That was Project Horizon, I think.
I don't know what Project Horizon was.
Oh, okay.
But Becker was involved with the Army, and so when we began developing the wheels, the wire wheels, the Army people at Waterworth Experimental Station decided to do some evaluation of the thing.
Yes.
They began working on evaluations of lunar... That's how they got involved. It was pretty late in the game, though. That's mm-hmm. how the Army got involved.
Okay, yes.
Experiments.
Well, let me ask you this. Once Boeing got the contract, who was your opposite number at Boeing that you were working with?
Well, the guy to the program manager was Earl Harris, HUTC.
Okay, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then Gene Coward was the engineering manager.
Okay.
It's my counterpart there was Earl Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And my chief engineer was Ferenc Pavlik.
Okay. What was...
His counterpart at Boeing was Gene Coward.
Okay.
Do you have those names?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So that's how we... And then there were a whole host of other people...
Oh, there had to be, yes.
...involved in this. When the program was in the middle of building the three flight units, we built four flight units, I had about 300 people on my staff.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of people from Milwaukee... Wisconsin, people have worked on the Apollo navigation and guidance, so they knew what space rating was, and so we leaned on them heavily.
I see. What was your title, if you will, at, it was it Delco at the time, or was
no, it? GM AC Defense Research Labs.
Yes, okay, because I...
Didn't become Delco until the program was almost over.
Oh, I see. That's good because
I'm never really involved in it.
Okay, okay. I'll keep that proper name there and only make mention of Delco.
Delco became Delco right at the very end when Delco then took over the Santa Barbara Laboratories and it was called Delco Research. Delco
mm-hmm.
Defense Research Laboratories was called.
I see. Okay.
And first, it was AC.
Right.
Defense Research Laboratories. And
okay.
Then AC and Delco merged, became Delco.
All right.
I spent that office for almost 19 years, and I didn't move an inch, but my position changed, but my home office changed about five times.
Okay. When when?
Can't see names on me.
Okay.
I was with General Motors all the time.
I see.
Anthony, you wanted to ask some questions. I'm here filibustering.
Well, that's great. You give me a very good background because that helps me formulate my questions.
Okay.
First of all, when the contract was awarded to Boeing and AC was really was AC subcontracted by Boeing, or was it a mutual arrangement in the contract arrangement?
No, Boeing was a prime.
Yes.
We were subcontractors of Boeing.
Okay, I just wanted to make that distinction.
And even though we started this whole thing and really carried it, it was, of course, you know, I've been involved in the military electronics and military stuff for a long, most of my career, so I understood the nature of prime contract and subcontract and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I became a subcontract, and it was fine with me. We were expecting Boeing, with their tremendous experience with it. At that point in time, Boeing had a program called the TIE program,
mm-hmm.
technical integration. Remember when they first, when they had that big fire with the Apollo 1?
Yes, Apollo 1.
Mm-hmm. And that's when NASA got contracted with Boeing on the TIE program,
mm-hmm.
technical integration or something. I don't know what it stands for, but Sonny Moreno knows what it stands for.
I see.
It's called the TIE program.
Okay.
Boeing was very heavily involved, and we figured, gee, that's a good bunch of guys to team up with for this rover, and that's what we did.
I see. Okay. What was at GM? We'll call it GM for simplicity's sake.
Thank you much. I appreciate you doing that.
In Santa Barbara, when the contract was awarded, what was your title then at the time?
I was manager of the lunar missions laboratory.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. All right, that's great. What was your feeling regarding the timeline for delivery of the first flight unit? I mean, they only allowed I think a year and a half to do this program.
It was very tight, you know. within 21 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do all those things today, let me tell you. I've recently been involved in fuel cell development and buses and all stuff. You just can't work that fast anymore.
Well, Sonny said the same thing.
Did he?
It'd be flatly impossible today to do that.
Sonny and I worked very closely through the program. In fact, he was a great guy.
I just got to see him recently at the moon buggy race up in Huntsville in April.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I had spoken with him on the phone, but that was my first opportunity to actually meet him.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. Tell me how, because this is really a logistics, it's not a logistics nightmare, but there were a lot of things involved that you had to coordinate, and GM did primarily the mobility subsystem, correct?
Well, as I told you before, we configured the whole vehicle when we went down to Rod and showed him how we could fit it in there, okay? We had a concept configured.
Yes, I understand.
Boeing now was applied their tremendous space technology information to make it acceptable to as a manned space vehicle.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We had a configuration. Then they gave us the job of developing all the electronics for the drive and all the suspensions. Everything it moves, the wheels and one of the biggest problems was, of course, the shock absorbers. We had to have shock absorbers that, with the fluid that didn't leak.
The dampers, yes.
Mm-hmm. The dampers, yeah. That was a big problem.
Wow.
And of course, the wheels were a big problem, too.
So the dampers were actually fluid-filled?
They were in silicon, yes. And as I say, look, you guys, if this vehicle is on the Saturn and it starts leaking, we're going to just throw it the hell off.
Yeah. Okay. There were schedule problems. The thing fell behind schedule, and for understandable reasons.
It didn't go behind schedule. What happened? Went over course.
Oh yes.
Course problem, not a schedule problem.
Okay.
From my point of view, we were never behind schedule, but we had an overrun, a tremendous overrun, and that made the Huntsville Dr. Reese, he made him very angry, and he came to see us. We had a come to Jesus meeting here in Santa Barbara with all the Boeing guys.
Okay.
But we were never behind as far as I could tell.
I'd like to talk about the drive system because, I mean, that's something where GM would excel, both the traction drive and the suspension design, and that was all engineered right there in Santa Barbara?
Right here, yep.
Okay. Because a lot of people have the perception, Sam, that Boeing engineered this thing.
I know.
And if you read the fine print, you'll see somewhere GM AC Delco Electronics Division.
Right.
But also the actual design of the wire mesh wheel was also done there in Santa Barbara. Is that right?
Do my guys have the patent on that?
Oh, is that right?
I have a copy of the patent for you.
Oh, that's it's little information like that I was hoping to discover, and that's great news because.
As a matter of fact, Anthony.
Yeah.
When I do it halfway through, if you milk me as much as you can, I want to give you the name of my chief engineer, Ferenc Pavlik.
Okay.
Incidentally, just got back 3 months ago from Hungary, where they had a big space meeting. He's very famous in Hungary because he's Hungarian. He escaped from Hungary during the 56 Revolution.
Wow. Yes.
He came to New Jersey. They were all housed in that army base in New Jersey. I forget the name of it right now.
Okay.
Then from there he went right to the Detroit Arsenal.
Oh, okay.
But Dr. Becker, who was at Detroit Arsenal, hired Ferenc Pavlik, and they worked there for quite a few years. And when I was in Detroit and got the job to put this rubber proposal, I said, "Boy, I need some mobility experts." So I hired Dr. Becker right out of the army, and he brought Mr. Ferenc Pavlik with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was in 1960.
And
that's how we got started on designing a vehicle for the moon for the NASA program.
Okay, and how do you spell his first name?
F-R-E-N-C.
F-R-E-N-C.
C-E.
C-E. Okay.
Alex, P-A-V-L-I-C-S.
Got that, yes.
And you ought to talk to him because he's a wealth of information.
Okay. I'm making a note here.
He's the principal on the patent, by the way.
Okay. On the wheel, that's fantastic.
It was my department, but I was a modest guy. I could have had my name on it if I wanted to, but I think these guys did it. You get your name on it. You guys did it. You, the three of them did put their name on it.
Okay, terrific.
Typically, you can whenever your department creates a patent, the head of the department gets a name on it, but I said, oh, shit on that. You know, these guys did it, they're going to get it.
I think that's great because, you know, they're the ones that, it's written, I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. And,
oh, yes.
And the chemist who actually came up with a formula for nylon, Dr. Carruthers,
yes,
lived right down the street from us.
Really?
He obviously didn't prosper very much from his patent or his invention because DuPont got the glory.
Yes.
But he got the fame. And I think the ones who really create this stuff really should get the credit for it. I think that's great.
I'll give you his name, okay, and his number, okay?
Okay, terrific.
Santa Barbara, right? 805. 682.
5966.
Right.
Okay, great. Maybe you can talk with them in a day or two and give them a heads up.
We usually have lunch on Tuesday, so we'll have lunch tomorrow and I'll tell them.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Terrific. Well, I think the thing that amazes me most about this whole program is the incredible pace of the whole thing.
I got an ulcer on that program.
I'm sure some people got worse than that, but it's the pace was just crushing because everything had to be engineered concurrently, didn't it?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Because we had a lot of background. We never worked on that configuration.
Mm-hmm.
We came up with it when I went to Washington and decided they gave us this, how little weight they gave us and how small a apartment to fold a damn thing. That was the first time I came up with a folding scheme. He was the genius out behind that.
Who's that?
Ernest Alex. Alex.
Oh, yes, the gentleman you just mentioned.
The folding scheme.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. I'm making a note here. While I'm recording, I'm making a note so I know what to... All right, but you have the deployment system, right?
Yes.
I see, okay.
Well, the folding is what was... And the deployment, that's it.
Well...
Amazing, you know, when he folded the jet, he was made in three pieces.
Exactly, and I don't think that had ever been done before on any kind of vehicle, was it?
No. That was really, really a remarkable configuration.
It is.
And then he tucked the wheels in. There were no special springs or anything to unfold this thing. It was the wheels had the suspension was under tucked, and then when you release the thing, it popped out.
Mm-hmm.
As the astronauts pulled the chain or pulled the lanyard. Think forward out and automatically deployed.
Yes, yeah.
Amazing. That was our scheme, not Boeing, that was GM and my department's scheme that did that.
Okay, okay.
Frank Havoc was the chief engineer for that.
Okay. All right. From your viewpoint, I mean, it was all challenging. What do you think was the most difficult system or subsystem in the LRV that GM had to cope with?
Well, I told you that the shock absorbers were very difficult.
See, a lot of people wouldn't even think of that as an issue. They would have think maybe the wheels would be the issue.
Well, we've been working on wheels like that for almost 4 or 5 years on our original Molad.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Original Molad, we had those wire wheels in our Molad.
Yeah.
We didn't even know what was going on.
Yeah, of course, Bendix came up with their idea.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And you talked to Ed? Ed who?
Ed Marco.
No, I haven't. Was he head of the Bendix program?
Yes. Yeah, we were very good friends. As a matter of fact, we still are.
Yeah.
We were competitors.
Well, I've read about the Bendix story, and they invested as much time and effort
Wait a minute. I beg your pardon. Ed Marco was with Grumman.
Oh, I see. All right.
The guy with Bendix was Chuck Weatherhead.
Oh, Chuck Weatherhead. Okay.
Weatherhead, yes.
Okay.
But the good guy to talk to would be Ed Marco, but I don't know where he is. He's in Florida somewhere. Hey, you're in Florida too, right?
Yes, I am. I'm in Miami.
Anyway, so we said the shock absorbers would be in the wheels, of course. We were pretty confident we had the right wheel. But building that wheel, keep it as light as we had to carry the load that it had to, was a challenge.
Mm-hmm. I came across a picture recently that actually shows someone weaving the wires.
Yes.
In order to get the mesh that you would then form, I'm still fascinated how they could get all that in one piece without.
You rotate that wheel
and you can't see a seam anywhere.
You make a web, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have two bitter ends, right?
Yes.
And you want a bitter end is where the wires stick out, right?
Yes.
Then you take that flat thing and you roll it into a cylinder.
Okay.
Then you reweave those bitter ends into the regular wheel, so it's seamless.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the opening of that thing and you tuck it in.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a wheel out of it. That makes a donut out of it.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
That was all Pavlik's scheme.
Oh, really? It really is astounding because it just works so well, didn't it? It just.
I have one of those wheels in my office here.
Oh, that's great.
My home.
It's a real thrill to be able to be working on this book because the story on the LRV has never been told.
No.
In book form. A lot of other aspects of Apollo have been discussed, but not the LRV. So I'm glad I'm getting the story.
But, you know, Jesse, they're still up there, the three of them.
Yes, they are.
You know, by the way, Tony, if Sonny Moray, I got a medal for that, like Sonny did. Sonny's the guy that recommended me for the medal, as a matter of fact.
Oh, is that?
He's a very good, very good friend of mine.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, he still lives in Huntsville, of course.
Yes, he does. As a matter of fact, we had a 25th anniversary of the rover here, about 4 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good seeing him.
How did GM work with some of the other... GM had its subcontracts. For example, Eagle Pitcher did the batteries for the electrical control system.
Batteries.
Yeah.
Garrett. Garrett Air Research.
Yes.
The steering mechanism. The steering drive motor. Drive motor.
I see.
The drive train in the wheel was a very...
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody told you about that?
I've done a lot of reading on the traction drive and harmonic drive.
Harmonic drive.
Well, yeah.
Harmonic drive was the key. And that was invented by a guy in Los Angeles, an Italian fellow, and he licensed it to United Shoe Machinery.
Oh, I've read about this somewhere. Yeah. It was actually a,
United Shoe Machinery in Massachusetts built them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a headache, let me tell you. I was back and forth several times trying to get them to toe the line and make the space quality equipment, but they did a good job. They really came through with it. It's a very unique kind of. As a matter of fact, I have one of the elements here in my office also. It's a very hard steel, a bearing material steel that's shaped. And the way the harmonic drive works is you've got to distort that cup.
Mm-hmm.
Distort it in a rotary fashion. For example, we have stuffed the bearing in there
Was that the flex spline?
Yes, the flex spline is what you have to distort. Because you had to put two bearings in there that were offset.
Yes, yes.
If you turn the shaft, you would get that offset would rotate around the flex spline. Okay, see
mm-hmm.
that? Well, because it's not round. It's like an ellipse, it's not round. So when you squeeze it in there, you deflect the flex spine. So there, it's not a round anymore. It's sort of almost elliptical.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Now if you put a bunch of teeth on the outside of that ellipse, these teeth are almost like a spline, an air spline.
Yes.
And then you get a solid gear to measure that spline. Now when you put the bearing inside, the distorted bearing, that spline will then make contact with that solid gear in two places.
I see, yes, yes.
Now if I have 160 teeth on the spline and 160 teeth on the solid piece, 158 teeth on the spline, then we always have two teeth in contact.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're two teeth different from the flex spline to the solid spline.
Okay.
Now, if I turn that bearing and have that contact point move round and round and round, when it moves 360 degrees, the spline moves two teeth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're saying, yes.
So you divide that. The 160 by 2, you get 80. You get 80 to one gear ratio in one pass.
I see.
Pretty
okay.
Genius, huh?
Yes, it was. Well, I'd heard about this 80 to 1 ratio, but it was hard for me to visualize how they accomplished that.
Those numbers, 160 teeth on the outside and 158, and after you get two teeth in contact, as you run around, you only move one tooth at a time, or two teeth at a time. But the amazing thing here is the reason we had that flex line, because we didn't want the rotating parts to be subjected to the zero environment, the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you lubricated them, the lubricant's going to go away because, you know, it'll boil off.
Yes.
So what we did was, and the biggest problem there was the DC motor, which has a carbon brush.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a carbon brush, whether you know it or not, has that moisture in order to survive when it's running on a commutator.
Okay.
You got a copper commutator,
mm-hmm.
You got these carbon brushes, right?
Mm-hmm.
The commutators have, like, you know, like teeth, and as you run around, the commutator really rubs on the brushes.
Yes, it does.
And the reason the brushes don't wear out as often as they would might because there's moisture in the air.
Okay.
There's no moisture on the moon right now, right?
Well, these were filled with nitrogen, were they not?
Yes, with a 7% moisture.
Ah, okay.
So that the brushes wouldn't wear out.
Okay.
Well, like that. That's why we had that flex line, which was sealed.
I see, okay. I understand that now.
That was a tough problem, too, by the way. Making that flex line work so it wouldn't crack and break. You know, you're distorting it at a pretty high RPM, and that was very, very,
mm-hmm.
very touching.
What was the flex spline itself was made from what? Do you remember?
Steel.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah, 4100, I think it was. Hey, it was a long time ago.
Yes, sure.
It was bearing material.
Yes. Okay. What was, there were, I guess, a lot of pressure. Were you also responsible for getting the subsystems to Boeing so they could build the qualification unit?
Yeah, we built the
Was the qualification unit built first, or was the 1G trainer built first?
Entirely different things. The 1G
yes.
trainer was nothing like the rover.
Yes.
It was just configured like the rover. But, you know, if you're going to run a vehicle on the Earth, you can't have the same kind of wheels because you put a 1G guy on a rover that's designed for 1.6G, you're going to crush it.
Sure, of course, yeah.
So the 1G trainer was designed completely by Santa Barbara from every piece of it. Nobody, Boeing had nothing to do with the 1G trainer. We did the whole thing.
Oh, good. That helps me a lot, knowing that.
And we trained the astronauts, too.
They came here,
we took them to Pismo Beach. You ever hear of Pismo Beach?
Yes. In fact, there's a... I think a couple years back, Sonny did a short history of the LRV, and there's a picture in there of Jack, is it Lousma?
Lousma. The USMA, yeah.
On that...
Jerry Carr.
On the beach.
And Jerry Carr, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Dr. Becker and Ferris Pavlik.
Mm-hmm.
I was too busy trying to keep all the animals together. My arm letting go. not that day, anyway.
Yes. Okay, well, this is great. I'm getting some really good photographs from Mike Wright at Marshall in Huntsville that show a lot of the early prototypes and that sort of thing. So I think when this book eventually does come out, you'll be quite pleased with the whole thing. But like I said, I'll make sure you're getting the look.
One of the things that was really very interesting, we had to test that damn wheel, right?
Yes.
So what we did is we made a thing we called a carousel testing rig. We made a big merry-go-round.
Oh, I think I may have seen a picture of that.
Yeah, which had a trough.
Yes.
It was about a foot wide, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We had sand in there, and we put rocks and stones and bumps. And then we had the whole suspension, we have a suspension system mounted off the side, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we had that offloaded by 1.6G. I'm sorry, 4.6G.
I see.
So we had 1.6G, 5.6G, he had 1.6G on the sand. And then that carousel was powered. The wheel powered the carousel around an
Okay. So the wheel was actually driven, driving the carousel.
That's correct.
It wasn't powered separately.
No. The wheel drove the carousel.
Because I had seen this test fixture. That it was put actually in a vacuum chamber, I think, and put
that's
on...
That was a second test.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That was done up at Boeing. We brought the wheel and suspension, and we put it on this rolling road up, which we all put in that vacuum chamber. My guy designed that and did that.
Okay, yes. Okay.
That was a good test, too.
All right, terrific.
A lot of testing, I'll tell you.
There had to be.
In a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It worked very well.
I was in Houston
after the launch. I was at the launch. I went to Houston when the vehicle was progressing. And the first vehicle, as you remember, we had two steering systems, front and rear.
Yes, that's right.
One of the systems didn't work.
On Apollo 15, initially the front did not work.
That's correct. We were ready. I was sitting in the front, and Von Braun was about 3 or 4 rows behind me, and my ears got red. I said, "My God, I'm dead now." What happened, you know? The translunar flight, we had potentiometers. In those days, we had potentiometers for follow-up systems. You know, today, with the electronics we have now, we could have made that rover much simpler.
Yes.
But we had a potentiometer that, when the driver gave it a signal, he displaced the potentiometer, and then when the wheels responded, they corrected it. It's a servo follow-up, okay?
Okay.
What happened during the translunar mission, that potentiometer developed a film on it.
Oh.
And so they wasn't really making good contact. After the first, after a couple of runaround, that wore off.
I see.
And then the next time when they first did, they turned it off. They turned that steering off.
Yeah, they cycled the circuit breaker.
Yes, okay. But mechanically it was still connected, so it kept rubbing on the potentiometer, and it cleaned it off.
I see.
So the next day when they turned it on, it works.
Yes, exactly. Well, I've been...
It left it on for one or two runs by itself.
Because I spoke with Ron Creel, who was the thermal vacuum test engineer on this thing, and he came up with much the same conclusion, but I've been trying to find for months the explanation why it did not work initially and then worked later.
That's why.
Well, now I've got the story.
And if they had just left it... To take the circuit breaker up, after first 2 or 3 turns, it would have worked. It also would have worked.
I see.
That's okay. They did the right thing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Don't fool around.
Okay. Besides the damper, were there any problems that GM was faced with that really proved to be a headache for you?
That flex line was cracking all the time.
Oh.
We were supposed to pull a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
If it cracks, you're not going to get a vacuum. So, as we were testing, we just couldn't get the damn thing not to crack. And we ran it around a couple of thousand times, many thousand times, to get the rotation we need out of it. The damn thing would crack. It would fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with the United Shoe Shoe. We developed all different kinds of annealing of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
We really had some pretty good metallurgists working on that. The other big problem we had was trying to weld up the suspension system. You know, I think it's about, don't take this number now, I'm on the counter, but there was something like 10 to 12 welds that we had to make on that suspension system. You know, it was two A-frames, okay?
Yes, that's right.
And we had aluminum connectors, which had a hole through them, and the suspension were aluminum bars.
Mm-hmm.
We had to stick the bars in the end things and then weld it.
Okay.
And then you had to pull the sample to make sure you had the right strength. We had a devil of a time getting you know, first you weld it, then you weld up a sample in the same position.
Mm-hmm.
These were a vacuum weld technique.
Oh, so these parts were basically put together in a fixture,
yes.
Or a jig to weld them up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And getting all those samples to pull at the same strength in order to qualify the one suspension arm, it was a devil. You know, we had, we went down to North American Rock where we got this special, TIG welders they were.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Inert gas welders. See, it's coming back to me.
Okay.
And,
is it tungsten inert gas, is that?
TIG, tungsten inert gas.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it was done in a vacuum where we had inert gas and it was all in a chamber.
Yes, I see.
Chamber.
Mm-hmm.
We had everybody working on that. Even our vice president came down and tried to work. He was a metallurgist, so he came down and gave it a try.
I see.
Those were sweating days, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Qualified, and we would not have made it.
Sure.
That was the other.
Okay.